Let me just say things I don't want to be asked about. Structural geology and auto mechanics, okay? Because that I've sort of played out that. But anything in between, I'd be happy to. Yes, sir.
Yeah, prevention tends to be associated with early diagnosis, as you've been talking about. But there are other ways of possibly preventing of, you know, dietary adjustments and things. And one of the things that you talk about, prostate cancer, some recent epidemiology shows a very powerful correlation between pro-inflammatory omega-6 fatty acid levels and the incidence of prostate cancer, and also some correlation with breast cancer. Seems to me that there should be more attention paid to really preventing before it gets started, rather than catching early.
Your point is very well taken, and in fact, a chiropractor, are you still here, came up and mentioned something to me that made me realize that I needed to disentangle this word prevention, because it has different meanings in different contexts. We think of really two forms of prevention. One is health promotion. In some ways, this is, well, I like to think of it what your grandmother would have told you, although she might not have known about omega-3s. You know, don't smoke, drink in moderation, get plenty of exercise, rest, find meaning in life, all those basic things. And they are terribly important. To be fair, both candidates' health plans recognize that. That's very important, and my comments had nothing to do with that. When we move into the medical model, and this has nothing about identifying something wrong with patients. Health promotion doesn't look for something to be wrong. It looks for everyone to be better. But when the prevention moved into the medical model, it very quickly moved into finding things wrong with people, the early detection model. And that's the area where I'm raising questions, and I appreciate that question, to be very clear about the distinction between health promotion and early disease detection, which is the dogma I was dealing with. Yes?
A previous Cafe Scientifique guest was Dr. Steven Bezruchka, and he presented on the topic of, is inequality making us sick? What direction do you think the U.S. healthcare system should go rather than doing all these screenings?
Well, that's a hard question. First, I should not profess to be an expert in healthcare policy. I do work for the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Some of us are much more engaged in the politics of healthcare, involved right now with Daschle after it had been named head of HHS. And that is part of what our shop does. I am much more on the clinical side, asking specific questions about early diagnosis. So I do not want to profess to be an expert on what's going to happen in health policy in this country. I think, though, all the signs are that we're going to see a pretty big change. I think the nomination of Daschle sort of shows that. This is not a policy wonk like Ira Magaziner back in the 90s. This is a skilled politician who's going to deal with the politics of healthcare. We're going to address, not perfectly, but we're going to begin to address the issue of the uninsured more comprehensively. Whether we address the cost problem in a reasonable way is a much more difficult issue. And I think we just have to stay tuned to see about that. I hope, and that's what I wrote in the editorial about campaign myths, I hope we don't have the myth that by more screening and early detection that we will both save money and improve health. It does not pass the laugh test that it will save money. Whenever we look for earlier forms of disease, we end up treating a whole bunch more patients. The best evidence I can tell you for that is look at who's supporting this. It's medical centers, academic medical centers included, and pharmaceutical companies who are looking for ways to expand their markets. So it doesn't save money. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. Maybe we'd pay for it if it really helped people. And in some cases, it may really help people. but not in all. And in many cases, it's a much, much closer call. And I think it's one we need to share more openly with the population and have them understand there's a two-edged sword to it. There's some close calls. And in fact, different people can, in the same situation, the same risk of disease, may make different decisions about what they want to pursue in terms of how hard they want to have things examined to see what's wrong. There's a question here? I'm sorry, I thought I was
here.
Here. Oh.
So okay. What you're talking about, is it more of a problem of too much screening or inaccurate final diagnosis?
Yeah, the question is the problem too much screening or inaccurate diagnosis? Inaccurate?
Final diagnosis.
Final diagnosis.
Screening is just kind of the first step, and then it's followed up by other tests.
Well, case of cancer, the question is, what's the gold standard for what we should call cancer, right?
Right.
That becomes what's really the issue. And it's easy to portray it as an inaccurate diagnosis problem, but I don't think that's really fair to the complexity of cancer. There's so much heterogeneity out there, we're never going to be totally able to predict. We'll get better as we can read the genome of individual tumors, but we can never predict the tumor-host interaction with perfect certainty. Whenever we take on a strategy of looking for early forms of disease, we're bound to find some extra forms. There will also be inaccuracies and debates among pathologists about what really constitutes cancer. But by the way, your question raises a real important issue. You know, when we all hear the word cancer, what we hear is a lethal disease that if you don't do something about it, it's going to kill you. And in fact, that's still the definition in My Stedman's, which is the classic medical dictionary. You know, it's a tumor, the natural course of which is invariably fatal. But remember how the diagnosis is made. The diagnosis isn't made after someone's died. The diagnosis is based on an observation of how individual cells or how they look as a group. And I'm simplifying this a little bit. Is there a pathologist in the room? He or she will improve upon this. But it's basically about the appearance of individual cells and their overall architecture. My point is, those two things are very different: a disease that invariably kills you and making this decision at a single point in time about what's going to happen. That's fundamentally, it's not like they're idiots, it's just fundamentally a very difficult thing to do. By the way, it was never a problem when we were talking about cancers that surgeons held in their hands, brought out of the abdomen, and put on the, these were large, obvious cancers. There were no pathologic relatively few disagreements about what was cancer. It becomes a problem when we start looking at those small lakes.
But from a policy point of view, I mean, when you look at it, it's not a problem with too much screening. It's a problem with not being able to identify that dangerous cancer. Where do you put your money? In developing better diagnoses, molecular diagnoses that could tell you whether a cancer is invasive or proliferative index of the cancer? You know what I mean? That
I do know what you mean.
The potential danger of that abnormality would be.
I would argue that this is a problem we're always going to have whenever we try to advance the diagnosis. We may get better at that, but we're never going to be perfectly able to look at early abnormalities and decide exactly which ones are going to matter and which are not. We will get better at it, yes. And some effort should be made to get better at that. But by the way, probably the most important thing for doctors to be good at is to treat symptomatic disease. And I think it's easy for even oncologists to forget that. You know, the most valuable thing is to be able to treat someone who is sick with disease. So treatments matter too. Yes.
You didn't have colon cancer on your
team. No, I didn't. Yes.
Could you repeat the question?
Very good. Thank you. Remind me every time. The question was, I don't see colon cancer here. Why not? And the answer is because I don't think there's a lot of overdiagnosis going on in colon cancer. Interesting, isn't it? In fact, the incidence of colon cancer is falling. Now, is there a gastroenterologist in the room? A lot of the gastroenterology, these are the guys that do the colonoscopy, the medical doctors that specialize in colonoscopy and endoscopy, would say this is attributable to the early diagnosis of pre-malignant lesions in the colon. I think that's probably overly simplistic. My evidence for that is the decline started long before polypectomies, which was the main procedure they're doing, so it predated it. But the important message in colon cancer from my standpoint is we don't seem to see this extra bump of additional diagnoses associated with early diagnosis. What we do see is more and more Americans getting into a cycle of very frequent testing for which we have very little evidence about, you know, whether you should really be, you know, a person with one tubular adenoma should be back every 3 years for a colonoscopy, and there are a lot of people getting in that. So, but the direct answer to your question, there doesn't seem to be as much overdiagnosis. There doesn't seem to be any at the population level overdiagnosis of colon cancer. Let me just say the two tests, the question was, what would I suggest? And with reference to colon cancer. And then I wanted to step back and just give you a little sense of the state of the evidence of cancer screening. The two screening tests that have been best studied, the only screening tests that have been studied in randomized clinical trials, they are our gold standard of evidence, a true experiment where some patients are screened, others are not, are mammography, where we've randomized almost 500,000 women worldwide and still are debating exactly what the effect is, and colon cancer screening. Really, all the studies have been with the fecal occult blood, that blood test, checking the stool for blood. It looks like both those approaches have a small but real influence on cancer mortality. Small meaning it doesn't take it away, it's on the order of 15-20% reduction in mortality. So the U.S. Preventive Health Services Task Force recommends colorectal cancer screening starting at age 50. And I think that's a reasonable recommendation. Although I would also be the first to say that I don't think it's crazy if someone looked at the information, decided that benefit isn't that big. Colon cancer, again, you know, it accounts for maybe 2% of all deaths. And they said, I don't want to do this. I think these are things where people can make their own decisions. These aren't things we need to jam down people's throats. And that makes me a little different than some doctors. You know, I am not, if you're under any misperception that I am represent the American Medical Association or the American Cancer Society, I do not. I'm a little bit of an outlier. Less so than I was 10 years ago, though. It's interesting. It's interesting how the medical community has begun to recognize the problem of overdiagnosis. Yes, ma'am. I think it's largely in these cases reflects an increase in diagnosis. I won't say it all does. In breast cancer, there's some evidence that our enthusiasm for hormone replacement induced some cancers, and that delayed childbirth has some effect on cancer rates. So I'm certainly not saying they're not other factors. In thyroid cancer, I think this is virtually all over diagnosis. In prostate cancer, it's virtually all. In breast cancer, it's a little bit more complex. I wouldn't say, the question was, do I think all this additional cancer diagnosis represents overdiagnosis? And the answer is not all of it, but a large proportion of it.
Do you think that on the melanoma one, for example, that there is an increase due to more exposure to voluntarily? You know, we have.
Surprisingly, although sun is a risk factor for the more common cancers, the squamous cell carcinoma with the actinic keratosis before and basal cell, it's not that strong a risk factor for melanoma. Some melanomas occur in areas where there's absolutely no sun exposure, and I'll let you guess where those are. Yes, sir.
Yes, estrogen. Back, if you remember, or some of you will, back in the 70s, they said estrogen caused uterine cancer. Well, the problem was at that time, they weren't, women who still had uteruses were not getting progesterone, which is the hormone that has the effect that makes them slough each month, and immediately the uterine cancer problem went away. Somewhere along in the 80s or 90s, doctors started using Prempro, which is a combined hormone, which was used because women liked it because they didn't have periods. But when you take Prempro, the risk of breast cancer compared to 100, if you took 100 women who didn't take anything who had breast cancer, and women who took Prempro, you get 127 of them would get breast cancer. But if you give a woman estrogen alone, or estrogen cycled with progesterone, the actual risk of breast cancer drops to 87 for estrogen alone to about 92 for progesterone alone. And this was a large population of women where this study was done and reported in 2002 in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. And all the blame that went when this all furor came out was it called the HERS study, and the HERS study used 65-year-old women average who all had heart disease who took only Prempro and didn't take their hormones from the time they went into the menopause. And so the thing is that one has to kind of know the intricacies, and I think sometimes in medicine when we're trying to eliminate one problem, we cause other.
Well said. Thank you. Other questions? Yes.
Tagging on to that, you know, there's been all kinds of reports about, say, breast cancer, I think in particular, that it hits certain areas, that environmental factors.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that?
I was interviewed a number of years ago by a reporter in Marin County. Everyone know the demographics of Marin? Yeah, okay, so this is not an underserved area, and there is a lot of concern about an outbreak of breast cancer. By the way, there was also an outbreak of melanoma near the what are the labs in Berkeley?
Lawrence
Livermore. Yeah, and every once in a while there are these cancer outbreaks, and it's very interesting when you look into some of them. Certainly in Libby, I'm not saying that the asbestosis there is related to the problem I'm about to share with you. But you do get epidemics where it's really an epidemic of diagnosis. And what happens, and the one I've studied the best, and Marin probably falls into this category where there's a great deal of mammography and looking for early forms of cancer. But probably the best story that was actually followed by the Washington Post was the story in Lawrence Livermore, where, you know, one employee got a bad melanoma. That happens. And immediately there was more concern in the lab. And there was a lot more interest in checking themselves to see if they had melanoma. And in fact, the Labs Health Services got involved and brought on more dermatologists. And all of a sudden, there were more and more cases of melanoma. And this led to a real panic. And it was only about 20 years later that we realized there was no change in the melanoma death rate in this group. The melanomas that were found were all early stage melanomas, thin melanomas. This was really an epidemic of diagnosis, not a true epidemic of cancer. That just brings home this point that I think is important is, you know, to what extent we think people have cancer is in some part a function of how hard we're looking at them. One story I didn't share with you is a lung cancer story. And the lung cancer story is actually a very interesting one, at least to me. Maybe you won't find it interesting, but what's the one thing you know about lung cancer? Okay, that's right for $100. You think lung cancer, you ought to think smoking. Do non-smokers get lung cancer?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's actually, you know, it's still, you know, there's a huge risk factor with smoking, the single most important risk factor for cancer, bar none. And yet non-smokers still get lung cancer. There's been a lot of interest about spiral CT screening for lung cancer. Some of you may have seen that in the paper. Spiral CT is a CAT scan that is fast enough that it can image your whole chest in a single breath. That took some serious computing power to take all that information in. Because, you know, most people have to breathe. And so if you get a good image, you've got to be able to take an image at the time of a single breath. A lot of interest about finding early lung cancers. And so the New York group, who I think is totally egregious, affiliated with, having some relationship with General Electric, the maker of scanners, did a study, and to see how spiral CT would work for lung cancer. And they all of a sudden were blown away by how much lung cancer they found. And they were so thrown off by this, to their credit, that they said, we're not even going to biopsy every abnormality we see, because we'd be biopsying too many people. A lung biopsy is not a trivial issue. You got to stick a needle into the lung. Lungs can collapse, and that can require more medical intervention, and occasionally will even lead to death. So they said, we're going to actually follow these lesions over time, these nodules on CT scans, to see whether they grow before we biopsy them. That was actually a step forward, but they were so intent on screening for lung cancer that actually the Japanese started to try it in a big way. And they did mass screenings of a few communities in Japan, and they found virtually the same number of lung cancers in smokers as non-smokers. Now, that's amazing to a cancer epidemiologist, where we know the death rate from lung cancer is 18 times higher in smokers than non-smokers. So it shows you the machine can unearth a whole different category of disease. Whether we can ultimately distinguish which will matter or not, I think is the cards out on that. But even lung cancer, which is a horrible disease, you know, our understanding as clinicians of lung cancer is it's the worst, right? More Americans die from lung cancer than the next five cancers combined. Once you're diagnosed clinically with lung cancer, the chances are we're not going to be able to cure it. Most people diagnosed with lung cancer die from lung cancer. You all know those things. Could overdiagnosis be possible in this disease? Yes. And that was amazing when all of a sudden you realize just about as many non-smokers as smokers had pathologic evidence of the disease. And that's the problem we're up against. Barr.
Well, so I'm still stuck as a patient.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know we could go on all night, but do you have a few pointers of when we decide not to listen to the doctor or to the
Barr, I want to thank you for giving me the easiest question of the night.
Repeat the question.
The question is, Gil, how are you helping me? You're just making my life more difficult. Is that a fair? Yeah. What should the patient do? How am I supposed to use this information? And first, I'm not sure I'm going to give you a satisfactory answer. I want to start with that. But let me try. The first thing I think is we all need to be a little bit more skeptical about sort of medical dictums, particularly when we're well. By the way, I encourage you to see your doctor when you're sick. I'm not, you know, I'm a conventionally trained Western physician. See your doctor when you're sick, when something's wrong. the question is, to what extent to be engaged in the process when you're well. So that's point one. Second, if you have a little skepticism, you'll have a little understanding why a doctor might say, I don't recommend this test, or I don't recommend this test quite as frequently, or I recommend this that you stop doing this at age 70. Those may not be the bad doctors, they may be the good ones. Third, I think that helps you begin to interpret some of what you hear in the news media. The goal of this game is not to find the most cancers. Most reporters don't understand that. Digital mammography versus film mammography, digital's better, finds more cancer. MRI versus standard mammography, MRI's better because it finds more cancers. No, finding more is not the answer you want to hear. You want to know who can find the right cancers. So I think it's very important for the public to begin to understand the idea of who can find the most is not necessarily the goal that you are interested in. You want to know who can find the right ones. I think the other thing, Barr, that's important is if you do participate in screening, that you can then recognize that perhaps screen-detected abnormalities don't require as aggressive treatment as clinically detected abnormalities, that we have to be more open to, that it may be in our interest to be more open to less aggressive therapies for early forms of cancer. I don't know if that helps. And it also helps, I think the other thing is to the extent possible, I live in the real world, I know most physicians have 10 minutes, 15 minutes with you, but I think most physicians assume the public always wants more. I think that is our default assumption. When we get a patient that says, you know, I'm open to hearing about what you really think, that you may get a different set of answers. That a patient that's open to more conservative interventions or more conservative treatment pattern, that doctors will find that refreshing and maybe a little bit of a relief and be more open to talk about it. And I know that's not perfect, but that's what I can do. Yes, sir.
Dr. Welch, what would you say would be the take-home message for people here tonight from a cultural perspective? You talked about European culture, Japanese culture, with regard to your, what are you trying to share with us tonight?
The question was about culture, what this says about our culture. Is that, am I doing a fair?
What it says about our culture now, mm-hmm. and what
right. Well, I'm tempted to say I don't have a lot of culture. But I think our culture is, in some extent, reflects our medical culture. That a lot of doctors like to blame the patient. Say the patients want more. They want this. They want that. And in large part, it is a reflection of suggestions we've made or things that have happened in the news media that are really not very critical of new advances in medicine. The presumption is anything new is better than anything old. The presumption is anything that's more expensive is better. And that may not be true. And I think I have found that actually a lot of patients, a lot of the general population is actually open to hearing this. They know that what's happened to American medicine has always been more and more and more, newer and newer and newer, look harder and look harder, treat more, treat more, treat more. And I think people are interested to hear that there might be downsides to that, and that some of them have been worried about this for a while. And I bet we're all worried. I don't know if any of you see veterinarians, but some of us get awfully worried about the vets and the dentists too. I mean, you know, there is, as long as we have a sort of wild market approach to medicine where we're paid more to do more, the thing will be out of balance, or is likely to be out of balance. I think we're getting closer to the point where more people are recognizing that if there's no checks on this, on the financial incentives, there's no limit to what will be told we need to do. And I don't know if that's a very good answer to your question, or whether you would you like a follow up, because
I have a response to that.
Yeah. Okay.
The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, you know, they did some studies in Europe, and you don't find 80-year-olds dying in ICU in Europe. They don't have huge ICUs full of elderly people, and they aren't spending a fourth of their health care dollar on the last year of life that does not change the outcome. So I think depending on the culture that you're in determines the type of treatment that you get.
I think that's correct. Only thing I'd add to that is it's very tempting to say it's all about the dying. And I think an increasing problem in American medicine is about what we're doing to the well.
Yeah,
and I focus on this other end.
Die.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
One more question,
then we quit. Oh my gosh. I know you've been waiting very patiently. And please go ahead.
It's a health policy question. It might not be what you want, but
yeah.
Senator Baucus just released his plan for health care reform, and a central issue in that was that he wants to shift the emphasis from treating illness to prevention. And part of that is that he wants to encourage primary care, and the more primary care doctors and the more access to those primary care doctors, the better American health will be. Could you comment on that?
Yes, the question is about Senator Baucus, who's also going to be a key player in health care reform, has held out prevention as being a solution to the problem, and then you said more primary care practitioners as being a solution to the problem. I want to separate those two things, and now I need to fully disclose my self-interest. I'm a primary care practitioner. So, yes. We need more primary care practitioners. We need to pay them better. They need to get more respect. You know, is that easy? Okay. And I say that jokingly, but I honestly believe. I like to think as the medical care system gets more complex, more scientific complexity, also more financial complexity, it's really important to have someone to shepherd you through the system, someone who understands your preferences and can help you make decisions. So I hope that happens. The idea that prevention, and again, I want to separate out the health promotion and the early disease detection. I'm very nervous when people have some hope that if we just look for things to be wrong with people, we'll have a healthier population. I don't think that's necessarily right. I'm not saying it's all wrong, but I think we've got to be really careful with it. And believe me, we've got a lot coming down the pike, particularly with genetic testing, but we're also going to get more imaging. There's going to be a lot of pressure that is potentially in the situation, it will lead us all to be labeled as sick. Primary care practitioners do a lot of things besides prevention. They help manage chronic disease, and that's important. So I don't want you to think of primary care, and I know I always feel nervous when I'm talking against prevention. It's like going against the gospel or something like that. But I think we've got to be more realistic about it. Again, I want to separate out health promotion. But let's be honest, the doctors are not the place to run through your health promotion program. This is the place that these are things we got to think about.
That's for the nurses.
It may be for nurses. It may be for schools. It may be for families. You know, it's much bigger. They're probably not the best equipped to help the society move more, eat better. I mean, there's a limit to what you can expect doctors to do. And I think, and this is, you know, this. Well, I'll just say it, you know, our core competency is dealing with sick patients and patients with chronic disease.
Maybe that's the problem.
I don't think so. I think we've moved too far into a preventive model for physicians. I'm not saying for the society, but for physicians, I think it's led them to get distracted, and I think they're getting confused about their goals. But I know that's a different take. Anyway, thank you so much. We're supposed to stop. I'll be here. I'll be happy to go.